Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Health Integrationist Lena Berman with Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment. In the state of California, there's a widely accepted notion that Marin County, one of the wealthiest in the state, has a cluster of breast cancer in the women that live there. There are many theories about why this might be, but no one has come up with a conclusive answer. In fact, no one is even questioning the validity of this notion until now. This is a population of women who can afford the best of what medicine can buy. Perhaps this is a clue. Join us in the next hour as we look closely at the facts at hand to see if this cluster is a false positive designed to fund the cancer establishment. I want to explain that we are going to be listening to an interview with Peter Byrne. And the quality of the audio isn't perfect. There's a bit of a buzz. It's getting harder and harder to find landline phones with good sound, so I apologize for the quality of the audio. So welcome, Peter Byrne. If you would, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, my name is Peter Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E. I'm an investigative reporter and a science writer. I write for magazines as diverse as Mother Jones and Scientific American, and I've written several books on physics. My website's peterbyrne.info.
Today we're going to be talking about this misbegotten epidemiology that's behind this notion that wealthy white women are more at risk of breast cancer than any other group, that there is a breast cancer cluster in Marin. This is something that you disagree with. You disagree with this notion.
Well, not just me, but plenty of experts, epidemiologists, and breast cancer activists. I mean, it's not just Marin. The notion that wealthy white women are more at risk of breast cancer is applied to similar communities from Cape Cod to Seattle and Long Island and places where there's concentrations of women who are highly educated and professionals purportedly have more risk of getting breast cancer. And what's happened over the decades since the early 90s is that headline after headline has been generated in the corporate media claiming that wealthy white women are more at risk of breast cancer than, say, poor African Americans or Latino women. In San Francisco, the San Francisco Chronicle has been among the worst. It even had a headline a few years ago, Killer Stalks Marin. Now, you know, granted that reporters are generally fairly lazy, corporate reporters anyway, and, you know, they're not scientifically literate, they depend upon science and scientific studies for their information and upon the scientists who write the studies to explain them to them. And what's happened in the Bay Area is that there's been a kind of feedback loop where the more studies that come out saying that wealthy white women are at risk of breast cancer, the more mammograms these women get. And the feedback loop is that the more mammograms you get, not only the more cancers and non-cancerous type lesions are discovered by mammography, but the more false positives emerge from it. This is very well known, or increasingly well known now, because recent studies of mammography are showing that it actually causes more harm than good because of the phenomenon of overdiagnosis, which leads to overtreatment. So people are getting radical surgeries and undergoing chemotherapy and radiation when, you know, arguably a large portion of them don't need to do that. So this kind of meme has taken hold over the last 20, 25 years that wealthy white women are more at risk than, say, poor people, and that the odd part about it is that the only meaningful endpoint in an epidemiological study is the mortality rate. And African-American women have as much as a 40% higher mortality rate than white women in general. So, you know, if you look at who's actually getting more breast cancer and dying from it, it's poor people of color. Wealthy white women have much better access to high-quality care, if you want to call you know, the kind of over-diagnostic, over-treatment care that they're receiving to be high quality, which is certainly arguable.
There's not only problems with, I mean, you point out that the California Cancer Registry, their data is a mess. And not only does it miss this issue of impoverished women of color and people who don't have good health care, but that their actual techniques are inferior, their collection techniques, the false positives, the software. So why don't you say more about that?
Let me explain what a cancer registry is. 30 or so years ago, the California legislature passed a law saying that every cancer diagnosis has to be reported and recorded in a central registry. And many, many states have similar type of laws. And the Center for Disease Control, which is a federal agency, runs a series of registries, as does the National Cancer Institute. But oddly enough, only about 28% of the population of the United States is actually covered by cancer collection data. And the government spends tens and tens of millions of dollars a year funding government institutions and nonprofits to collect this data. But the dirty little secret of it is that the data is very problematic. It's full of quality problems. It's full of errors. And it's understandable in one sense because doctors who are the originator of the data tend to keep kind of, you know, messy records. You know, it's famously hard to read doctors' handwriting. And the cancer registry sends registrars to doctors' offices, or it has over the years, and they're supposed to read these records and decide, you know, if there's a cancer diagnosis, and then there's like hundreds of codes, numbers that pertain to, you know, what type of cellular structure it is, and what the grade of it is, and, you know, when it was diagnosed, and, you know, how serious it is. And by the time that this data gets transferred from the doctor's office to the central electronic database in the computers in Sacramento, understandably, a large portion of it is corrupted by human error. So when, for instance, a cancer registry says they have 97% accuracy, well, if they're collecting, say, a million records, then that means that 30,000 of them are inaccurate. And when you're doing epidemiological studies of small communities like Marin, which only has about 70,000 women of breast cancer age, those numbers are too small to generate any type of real-time analysis. Because if you've got, in the state of California, say, you know, tens of thousands of errors in the cancer registry itself, you don't know where those errors are. And when you've got an assertion by an epidemiologist that the cancer rate, say, in Marin is 125 out of 100,000 women, the error bars, as they call it in science, are just too large to encompass the kind of elevated rates that are seen. Because if you say you started out at 125 cases per 100,000, and then the next year you've got 130 cases, that's only 5 cases per 100,000 women, you know. And if the error bars are thousands and thousands of cases, you can't make a meaningful statement on that. Epidemiology was never set up to examine small populations. It's very good at tracking movements of diseases in large populations and at trying to find out what the cause of a disease is. But it can never tell you exactly what the cause of a disease is. It's only a hypothesis-generating mechanism. It looks at data, it does statistical analysis, and it says, this disease may be caused by X, Y, and Z. And then people have to go out into the field and try to figure out what that is. But what we've seen happen with this kind of trope that wealthy white women are more at risk of breast cancer is that over the years, the epidemiologists have never been able to say why that would be. I mean, obviously, they have better medical care. They tend to live in communities with less toxic waste elements, you know, like that surround a lot of African-American communities who live near power plants and things like that. And so they always say, we don't know why it is. We need more money to study it.
Well, let me ask you something before we go there. The information you just shared, which I would assume that the records are somewhat improved by having electronic records, even though I'm not a big fan of them.
No, that assumption would not be true.
Okay.
They're actually more vulnerable, because what has happened is that all these different registries around the country, and even within California, which has like 9 different registries, they tend to have different software systems. They don't talk to one another. And the software systems have lots of bugs, and they themselves have high error rates. So if anything, it has made the accuracy of the data less reliable. Now, I talked to one of the people that is in charge of, you know, information science at the registry in Sacramento on Friday, and, you know, they basically ruefully admitted that that was the case, that the data is actually not of the kind of quality that you can make any kind of meaningful assertions in small populations, and that they're trying to develop computer systems that make it more efficient. But, you know, it's like any other government enterprise. You know, if you get, like, Oracle Corporation to come in, you give them, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to build a database. Example, in California, they were given hundreds of millions of dollars to build a database to track people on welfare, and then every 2 years they say, well, it doesn't work, we need more money to make it work, and this has been going on for 20 years. So you have these software corporations are actually paid to fail. So it's the same thing is going on with cancer registry type data. It's a very sad situation.
Certainly. There was a recent article that was in the New York Times. Gina Colata, who is their science writer, actually did an article about yet another study that came out, I guess this one in the British journals.
Canada.
Canada. Okay. About the problems with mammography. Can you talk about the article?
Yeah. You know, in epidemiology, they often talk about the so-called gold standard, which is a long-term randomized trial. To digress, I mean, there really is no such thing as a gold standard, according to many leading epidemiologists. There's so much bias that is introduced at any level of a clinical trial that it's very difficult to say with any certainty what the cause of any particular disease is. But in Canada, there was a very large-scale randomized trial designed to reduce those types of biases, and, you know, probably did to some extent. They went on for 25 years, and they recently released some information summing up 25 years of studying, I think, mammography over 100,000 women, showing that 1 out of 5 mammograms causes serious harm, in that there's so much overdiagnosis because the advances in mammographic technology find such small cancers, the cancers that actually do not need to be treated, or lesions that are not cancerous but are called cancer and treated as cancer, that for every life that may be saved potentially statistically by mammographic screening, literally dozens and dozens of women are harmed by being given false diagnoses, by the anxiety of having to have a mammogram say that you are a candidate for breast cancer, and then a biopsy that may or may not say that you are. Women are not told that biopsies have a 20% false positive rate, so you should never rely on one. You should get 2 or 3. And the conclusion of the trial was basically, and the headline was, that mammography causes more harm than it does good. And, you know, this has been something that has been asserted by scientists that were looking at the situation objectively for literally 30 years, ever since mammography became kind of the poster child of the big pink kind of corporate breast cancer advertising movement. You know, every woman is urged to get a mammogram at the age of 40. But there's a real downside to the whole thing, and the Canadian trial explicitly shows that the downside is that, you know, if you had to take a vote, say in a democracy, one woman's life is saved by mammography, and then 50 women are seriously harmed. Well, the one woman whose life was saved would say, yeah, mammography is great, let's keep doing it. But the others might not. So you have a kind of disparity between how people look at breast cancer screening or any type of cancer screening from the point of view of themselves or their relatives or friends benefiting from it, as opposed to the huge groups, much larger groups of people that do not benefit from it, that are indeed harmed by it and harmed by the overtreatment that goes along with it. So it's a very difficult question, and it's fraught with a lot of emotion, and it's a real minefield to report on because, you know, people are scared to death of cancer, and especially, you know, breast cancer in our society has taken on this huge, looming kind of Cold War, Red Menace type of thing that has to be battled in a military sense. And when you get it, if you don't win, then you weren't battling it hard enough. And, you know, that's contrasted with this whole victimhood thing that goes on with it, you know, and the elevation of people that survive is like, you know, some kind of soldiers that went into battle and came out victorious. You know, this does a lot of harm to people because it doesn't accurately describe, for one thing, what the actual risks are.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. You're hearing an interview that I'm doing with Peter Byrne, and we're discussing the false positives of this sort of notion that there is a breast cancer cluster among rich white women.
But let me roll this back a little bit, because you're talking about how much money various organizations are trying to raise. Cancer, industrial treatments for cancer, conventional, it's an industry. The cancer, it's an industry. It's a cancer industry. Yeah, it's a huge industry. And there are many people who benefit financially from this. And you've mentioned a number of places where this would be true. So if you would, maybe you can give us some kind of idea of how this is being driven by economics.
Well, first of all, it's like a $3 billion a year treatment industry. I mean, the drug companies are making huge amounts of money on these overpriced chemicals that are basically used to poison a woman's body. And, you know, even the most highly touted breast cancer treatments or treatments for lung cancer, any type of cancer that's chemotherapy, they may give you like 5 months extra, you know, average lifetime, but that's a lifetime filled with having to wake up in the, you know, morning with, you know, all the side effects that go over.
But aside from the treatment problems, let's talk specifically about things like the Marin Department of Health and Human Services being funded by Avon, and about some of the other places where there are conflicts of interest.
The whole Big Pink complex, so-called, is over the years, corporations like Avon and Baker Hughes and Estee Lauder, you know, corporations that manufacture carcinogenic or potentially carcinogenic products have thrown tons of money into, you know, what we call the Big Pink complex, you know, the pink ribbon-oriented complex. And not only do they mount campaigns urging people to get mammograms, because, of course, if you get mammograms, then you usually get treatment. So the drug companies like that, and they're a big proponent of this Big Pink thing, AstraZeneca, for example. But a group like Avon, you know, has been in the forefront. And Avon manufactures what they call personal care products. I call it cosmetics, you know, why not? And cosmetics have ingredients like cadmium, which is a known carcinogen. Cosmetics with carcinogenic ingredients have been banned in Europe and around the world, although they were not banned here in the United States, due to a lot of activism by groups like Breast Cancer Action and the Breast Cancer Fund. Avon and Estee Lauder have been slowly removing some of these carcinogenic ingredients from their products. But in the meantime, they've thrown a lot of money into creating a public image for themselves as the friend of women who have breast cancer. And part of it goes into public relations, and part of it goes into funding research. In Marin, they threw well over $1 million at the Marin Department of Public Health to study the personal behavioral habits of women in Marin that could be linked to the supposedly high rate of breast cancer. And they administered a questionnaire of about 80 different questions where they asked people about the use of hormone replacement therapy and whether or not their pets had flea collars. In fact, they asked a huge variety of questions. The only thing they didn't ask was if women use cosmetics. And that study, it kind of petered out after a while. They interviewed a lot of women. They took saliva samples, and apparently it really didn't go anywhere after spending several million dollars. But what it did do was keep alive this notion that wealthy white women in Marin are more at risk of getting breast cancer, even though they die from it at a substantially lower rate than anybody else. So you can see that, you know, Avon is a very, covering all of its bases, you know, I mean, even as part of the millions that it was given to the Marin Department of Public Health, which is, you know, a government institution, gives one of the local activist groups called Zero Breast Cancer a fifth of its annual budget. It gives it about $100,000 a year. And when I interviewed the head of Zero Breast Cancer, Janice Barlow, I asked her directly, I said, why are you taking money from Avon when it manufactures products that may be causing breast cancer? And she said, well, our board of directors thought long and hard about this, and we decided two things. We decided, one, that, well, we all use makeup, whatever that means, and two, this could be a teaching moment for Avon, as this being associated with an activist group is somehow going to turn around the global agenda of a multinational, multi-billion-dollar corporation. I think, you know, more cynically, what it did was it dulled the voice of the activist group, and it certainly created a conflict of interest that would diminish its credibility. And this, you know, has been going on all over the country, where pharmaceutical companies and cosmetic companies are throwing money into research that diverts people's attention from the true causes of breast cancer, which are, one, genetic, and two, environmental.
Yeah, actually, we just did a show about epigenetics, which kind of kicks the genetic stuff out the window, but that's another issue.
Cosmetics are an enormous source of exposures to environmental toxins, and as Jeffrey and I have been covering in other programs that we've produced, it's the toxins in the environment that predict what genes are going to get turned on and turned off. So it's very important to protect women from toxins. And not only are there toxins in cosmetics, but there are fragrances in personal products. A couple of places to look at to get more information would be the Environmental Working Group has a website called Skin Deep, where you can look up chemicals in personal products and laundry products and all the rest of the products. Everything is fragrance nowadays. Even if it lists a natural fragrance, the fragrance industry, which is like the flavor industry, can call something natural. And all it means is that the chemicals that are in it are the same chemicals as in a smell that is derived from a biological substance. But these are not natural smells, and they persist, and they do cause some harm. But they're allowed to call them natural. And Steineman, PhD, has done studies, and we haven't had her on the show for a while, but we have in the past, where she aerialized different products, like laundry products and other things that have fragrances, clothes, things, soaps, cosmetics, all these things that are in our environment with fragrances. And she discovered, when she aerosolized the materials, so that she could test in the air what was in them, she found the most dangerous cancer-causing chemicals you can that there are, you know, toluene and benzene rings and all this stuff. So fragrances are an enormous problem along with cosmetics.
It's also important to note that, like the flavor industry, the fragrance industry and cosmetic industry is protected in terms of consumer information. You can't find out what is in those products. That's why Anne Steineman had to do what she did to find out what was in there and how those work. And again, as Peter notes, that the cosmetic industry is very much involved in the pink ribbon movement, which makes me believe that, like the phenomenon of greenwashing and in the environmental movement, where polluters pay for a good reputation for their good environmental works, that there should be an equivalent pink washing that companies like Avon and other makers of products that are provocative in terms of breast cancer keep up the keep up their good name, good brand identity, and also become tightly knit with both the research community and with the government agencies that don't regulate them, that potentially can direct research money toward or away from their products.
Why don't you also remind us how the cancer registries are embedded with treatment providers?
Well, the registry in California, which is supposed to be the best in the world, is operated by the California Department of Public Health, and is funded by millions and millions of dollars from Washington, D.C., National Cancer Institute, Centers for Disease Control. And it turns around and it subcontracts the management of the registry out to nonprofits such as the Cancer Prevention Institute of California or the Public Health Institute, which is a little-known, huge nonprofit that runs a lot of medical services in California and elsewhere. And these nonprofits employ epidemiologists who are tasked to study the data that is collected by each of the organizations and to try to predict what the causes of breast cancer could be over time. So you've got kind of built-in conflict of interest where, say, the Cancer Prevention Institute of California is not only collecting data, it's also analyzing it. And year after year after year, it keeps promoting this notion that wealthy white women are more at risk of breast cancer than anybody else. Unfortunately, one of the main epidemiologists there, Dr. Christina Clark, regularly testifies in lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies who have manufactured hormone replacement therapy, and her studies purportedly show a link between the use of hormone replacement therapy and breast cancer. And she is paid a sum of money to testify to that effect in court. Now, whether or not there's a link is another question, but it's a built-in type of conflict of interest for a breast cancer researcher to be taking, you know, huge sums of money to make expert testimony on behalf of anybody. In that case, it happens to be women that maybe suffered, but there's another researcher who's really big in the field. His name is Chlebowski, based at UCLA, I think. And he actually consults to AstraZeneca and other Eli Lilly and other pharmaceutical companies. AstraZeneca is the manufacturer of tamoxifen, which is a chemical that is given as a preventive to people, so-called preventative. And he regularly comes out with studies saying that it works. So, you know, whether or not that's true, we have a scientific system that has conflicts of interest built into it. And, yes, I know these associations because they disclose them in the small print at the bottom of the papers. But, you know, who reads those papers? You know, I know most reporters don't. And, you know, it's good that they disclose these financial conflicts of interest, but why do they have them at all?
It's commonly accepted that the two things that cause cancer are genetics and environment, as Peter mentioned, and Lena rightly corrected him based on interviews that we did recently with a toxicologist and a researcher in the field called epigenetics, that in fact, in general, that the association between genetic markers, such as the so-called BRCA breast cancer gene, are very low. The really appalling thing about the BRCA gene and what happens to it is it's used as a way to spread fear again. And I mean, in this other weird way, it becomes like cesarean sections, that if you have this gene, you need to have a double mastectomy to prevent you from getting breast cancer, which just on the face of it makes no sense. To prevent breast cancer, avoid exposures that will increase your risks of breast cancer. But more importantly, the science just simply isn't there to support that notion. The statistics that I have looked at suggest that although within the realm of conventional research, although the risk increases by a factor of about 3, that's within the very narrow and biased frame of reference that's used for conventional research. So the idea that genetics determines whether or not what your risk of breast cancer is really a misunderstanding of what genetics actually means, and the very fundamental fact that it is environmental exposures that create risk, not genetic predispositions.
We need to take a brief musical break. I'm doing an interview here with Peter Byrne, and when we come back, we'll continue this discussion about whether the so-called cancer cluster in Marin County in California is indeed a false positive. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please send us an email to admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. In fact, it is the environmental exposure that turns on and indeed turns off genetic expression. So it really doesn't matter whether you have a predisposition in your family line. What matters is your environment and whether or not that's provocative. So your environment includes your psychological and social environment and your socioeconomic status, which is a stressor, how much stress, you know, what your young childhood was like, that environment, your food environment, your consumption of recreational items of various sorts, including alcohol for women with breast cancer, very important, and for men who get breast cancer as well. Alcohol is very provocative. And nutrition, you know, genes are also turned on and turned off in response to nutrients, vitamins and minerals and things that help with this. So the important thing to remember is even if you have in your so-called genetic line or family line a predisposition toward breast cancer, it's going to be your environment as an adult that predicts whether or not the conditions are correct for those genes to turn on. That's much more important than what your so-called family line shows.
One of the things that conventional cancer theory cannot explain is why endocrine disruptors such as phthalates, which are found in cosmetics, cause cancer. Why they are exposure to those things and other endocrine disruptors are associated with increased cancer risk in lab animals. This becomes quite understandable from the standpoint of not your genes putting you at risk of cancer, but your environment causing epigenetic changes which turn on and turn off the expression of your genes. So here we have, and this is fairly new research. This is all the kind of research that has only come to light in the last decade or so, and is yet another failing of the conventional cancer industry of linking up environmental exposures with not genetic markers, but with how cells are managed through environmental exposure, how environmental exposures talk to your body.
You mentioned that there was a one-year drop in breast cancer incident in 2003 that was inaccurately attributed to a drop in the use of estrogen progesterone hormone replacement. Of course, traditional or conventional hormone replacement uses progestins, which are patented products that have their molecular structures changed. And progestins have been shown to cause all kinds of cancers and to interfere with the protective effects of estrogens in all sorts of studies. But I'm interested about this little piece here, that the drop in breast cancer in 2003 was inaccurately reported as being a drop in the use of replacement therapy.
Well, what happened was that there was a huge study called the Women's Health Initiative.
Yep.
And in 2002, one part of the study was stopped because the claim was that they had found a strong association between the use of estrogen plus progesterone.
Let's talk for a moment a little more, or let me talk a little more about hormone replacement therapy and its role in all of this. Peter did a pretty good job of talking about this. I mentioned during the interview the difference between hormones that have had their molecular structure changed so that they no longer match what our body makes in order to patent them to make them a product that they can sell as a drug for more money. So an example of that was the progestins that we were talking about, Provera, and the fact that for many, many years there were studies that kept showing that progestins and Provera were causing not only symptoms among women, but were provocative in terms of breast cancer. So another issue here is just any hormone that's been altered. So you're talking about birth control pills as well here, and certainly things that are used supposedly for prevention, like tamoxifen, which is basically a chemical castration. It's used sometimes in men too, but it erases all the hormones, and it itself has had very little study done, and the studies that are done don't show it causing protecting women from further cancers very well. It doesn't have a good track record, and it can and does sometimes cause other cancers. You can read about tamoxifen and some of these other issues in, this is an older book, but it's quite remarkable still. What your doctor may not tell you about breast cancer, you'll have to look for a used copy online. This is John Lee, L-E-E, M-D, and David Zava, Z as in zebra, A, V as in Victor, A, Zava, Ph.D. Wonderful book, and there's a breakdown of the studies done on these. Now, it's very interesting that he mentions the Women's Health Initiative studies. There were two, and the media. One of the things that happened right after they published the results, the media got hold of the results of the first WHI study, which was halted suddenly, and all this money that's taxpayers' money was wasted on it because they didn't follow through, because they said that the clotting events from the estrogen doubled. It said estrogen doubles clotting. Well, this is another situation where statistics were manipulated to make it sound worse than it was. The normal incidence of clotting, non-fatal clots, is 1 in 100,000, and these were non-fatal clots. It went up 0.1%, which means that now suddenly it's 2 in 100,000. So yes, that is a double, but you could also report that it went up 0.1%. So 2 in 100,000 people. So that's bizarre, and they halted the study. It's dangerous. Second study was done later, many years later. And in this study, they decided to test women with just estrogen alone. Now, I should mention here that in both studies, they only used Premarin, which is a horse estrogen, in a tablet. So this is an oral dose. Oral doses go directly to the liver, and in people who don't have good liver function, they bioaccumulate these hormones. They don't do well. When hormones are taken through the skin, the tissues pick up the hormone first, and then there's clearance later through the liver, so you avoid that first pass through the liver. This was oral dose, less protective. None of these women in either the first or second study were tested before they were given the dose to see if they even needed estrogen. Not every woman after menopause does. And, the dose was the same for everybody, same dose. Everybody gets the same dose. And in the first study, they used progestins, the synthetic Provera. In the second study, they did only estrogen. Now, what happened was quite remarkable, but very little of it got reported in the media. They did report there was a reduction in colon cancer incidence that went down. What they didn't report on, and the reason they didn't report on it, is there's a thing called statistical significance. In fact, the incidence of breast cancer went down very close to half, just a hair below half. So almost half of the women had, there was no breast cancer at all. So it lowered the incidence of breast cancer, but the amount, the percentage, was so slight as to take it out of statistical significance, so it wasn't reported on. They never bothered to do any studies with bioidentical progesterone, which has been studied by people who are not invested in the pharmaceutical industry, and it's been found that that without the natural progesterone, the bioidentical progesterone, the beneficial effects of estrogen are not very good. It doesn't help as much. Estrogen works better in the presence. And in fact, if a woman doesn't need estrogen, maybe only after menopause, needs a tiny bit of progesterone, natural, bioidentical, through the skin progesterone, she may find that the symptoms she was having of low estrogen will reverse because she just needs a little progesterone. So there's been terrible misinformation about, and these studies have been terrible in terms of what they've shown and how the media handled them.
Yes, no, I've covered this endlessly on the program and will do in this one as well. But go ahead and finish this story.
So what the upshot was is a few years later, some studies came out that were widely publicized saying that there was a drop in the incident rate of breast cancer the following year. So the hypothesis was that when the WHI study was stopped, that women no longer use that type of hormone replacement therapy as much, and I think that's true. There is statistics that show that. But then the claim was that a year later, since the rate of breast cancer incidence dropped somewhat across the country and in California, that meant that there was a link between the use of hormone replacement therapy and the existence of breast cancers in women. And, you know, when that came out in 2007, it was another big headline in the New York Times with Gina Colada, and it affected the stock price of Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, who was one of the manufacturers of that type of hormone replacement therapy called Premarin. And it did actually drive people away from using hormone replacement therapy. But to say that there was a link to breast cancer is completely specious and unfounded and unproven and probably unprovable.
Absolutely.
And, you know, first of all, the study itself, which scared people so much, showed only that the hypothetical increase in getting breast cancer from the use of E+P hormone replacement therapy was 8 out of 100,000. That is so small statistically that it's just a little random statistical fluke or blip, you know. It's completely wiped out by the error bars, you know. But it was promoted as a huge increase when it wasn't. And, you know, one of the reasons that this kind of breast cancer fear has been able to flourish is because a lot of people don't understand statistics specifically, and that's understandable. It's not that easy to grok, as it were. But when a study says that, you know, we had 2 out of 100,000 have this disease last year, and this year 4 out of 100,000 have it, it gets translated as 100% increase. It was 2, and now it's 4. It's doubled. But really, it's only 2 out of 100,000, which is like, you know, 0.02%, which is basically statistically meaningless. But these types of figures get blown up all out of proportion and translated in the media as these very fearful headlines that promote people to go and get tested for cancer and to accept these hugely expensive, often debilitating and unfortunately sometimes unnecessary treatments.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. You're hearing an interview that I'm doing with Peter Byrne, and we're discussing the false positives of this sort of notion that there is a breast cancer cluster among rich white women.
Yes. Well, the other thing to remember is that bioidentical hormones, hormones that match a molecular structure of a woman's bodies, are not patentable, and they're not expensive. So you have to turn it into a pharmaceutical product to make it. And the pharmaceutical products, the birth control pills and the tamoxifen and the progestins and the synthetic estrogens and the horse estrogens, not being native to the body, do cause some disruptions, but certainly not at the levels that have been touted in the media.
Well, and, you know, subsequently, I mean, that was some years ago, many studies have come out and some articles have been written about it saying that, admitting that that was a specious analogy, you know, a specious association or linkage, and that it really didn't hold up over time. So, you know, it's just an example of how, you know, the media interfaces with epidemiologists who are getting money from government and from big pink corporations to promote these really scary type of memes. And, you know, at the Cancer Prevention Institute of California, Dr. Clark, who I was speaking about earlier, you know, that's one of her main fields of study has been promoting this link between hormone replacement therapy that dropped in 2002 to the purported decrease in breast cancer incidence. But there was no real decrease. The same type of data that you would use to show that there was an increase also shows that there was a serious decline in the use of mammography from 2002 to 2003, which means that people were getting fewer mammograms, which means that there were fewer cases of cancer, whether it was real cancer or false positives, that were being recorded in the registry data. You know, but they don't talk about that in their papers except to say, well, it could have been that, but we don't think it was. We think there's a link. We can't prove it, but the headline is that there's a link, and that's what people take away from it. And, you know, the ugly reality of it is that, you know, if they came out and did a really comprehensive study that said all this supposedly elevated breast cancer incident rate in the Bay Area and wealthy communities is an artifact of excess use of mammography, then they would actually not have access to the kinds of funds that have been driving this type of, I think, phony study for 20 years.
I agree. And so what you're also saying here is that the media has had this role in promoting fear and all these myths about breast cancer, which I totally agree with. I used to, when Dr. John Lee was still alive, he had a 30-year practice in Marin County, and he was a pioneer in educating women about the non-altered forms of progesterone, the bioidentical progesterone creams, and the use of them. And he never saw in his 30-year practice, he had no breast cancer incidents in his practice. But since he's passed on, there are very few people taking this on, and we used to see articles in the paper, and then I would call him up, and we'd get on the air and tear them apart. So there's a real media role, too, which, of course, the media is increasingly supported by these institutions.
Well, also, I'd like to talk for a minute about what we're doing. This investigation that is ongoing and will be published this summer is called breast cancer money in the media. And its investigation is going to be published by the Point Reyes Light newspaper in West Marin, and it's being funded by a Kickstarter campaign called Busted. So if you want to read more about it, you can just Google Busted and Kickstarter, and it will come right up, or search for it on Kickstarter, and you can look at it. Campaign's over in about a day and a half, so better do it soon.
But if you don't, if people miss the deadline to contribute to you, can't they still follow you up at a website to see what you're continuing to do? Because there's going to be an ongoing
oh,
work.
Yeah, they can look at my website, peterbyrne.info, or they can visit the Point Reyes Light. Just Google Point Reyes Light.
So go back and give your website again more slowly and spell your name again.
Peter, P-E-T-E-R, Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, that's one word, Peter Byrne. .info, I-N-F-O, or you can just Google my name. And
is that .org?
No, .info.
So it's peterbyrne.info.
No, peterbyrne.info.
Okay. Okay, well, is there any last bit that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to add to this before we let you go?
Just that I actually think that this investigation is good news. I think that women in these wealthy communities actually have been running in fear of breast cancer inordinately for almost three decades now, and that the results of this investigation, which will be explained as clearly as I can from a scientific point of view and from an investigative point of view, can lift some of the burden of fear off of women in these communities, and it can also help to redirect public policy and funding to look at the real causes of breast cancer and to examine how it's disproportionately appearing in what they call socioeconomically disadvantaged communities, which we all know is poor communities, right? Mm. Usually with people of color in fairly toxic types of environments. So actually, this investigation has the potential to seriously turn around a really badly focused industry, because epidemiology, which is a kind of arcane science, has been the backbone of creating this fear. And once we, kind of pull the covers off of it and look at what the real risks are, we see that they're not as bad as people think. I mean, yeah, sure, breast cancer is, you still get it. It can be really bad and it can kill you, but the bottom line is that 2% of the people of women will die of breast cancer. That means that they're going to die 98% of something else. I mean, frankly, we're going to die of something, and I would just as soon die peacefully in my sleep. But what we need to look at is the real risk when we're deciding whether or not to go into the kind of harsh treatments that breast cancer and other types of cancers require. We should look at the real risk, because one of the biggest developments in the past year or so is that even the medical establishment is now backtracking on the claim that DCIS, or in situ breast cancers, should even be called cancer. And the tragedy of the last 30 years is that mammography has discovered such small types of cancers and such small types of lesions inside milk ducts that the claim is that these are either cancers or precancers, and the solution has been mastectomies and bouts of chemotherapy and radiation. And I have interviewed people for this story that underwent that type of treatment and then lived to regret it. One woman had that type of surgery. She had mastectomy, and then there was a biopsy done afterwards, and no cancer was indeed found. The original biopsy had been a false positive. And this just goes on and on and on. So what we need to do is women need to have, their partners and families need to have the best information available. And frankly, this information has been so obscured and sensationalized that it just doesn't exist at the moment. And if I do my job right, it will at least make a toehold in people getting this type of information so that they can make the types of decisions that they can live with.
It might be worth mentioning here that men also get breast cancer. Yeah. I think that's important. Peter, once again, if people want to follow you and find out how the investigation is going and where it's at, where should they go? We'll also put this on our website as well. But
My website is peterbyrne.info. I also, because I have to, I have a Facebook page, although I'm not too fond of it. I even tweet, but I really don't like Twitter, so don't even look for me there. If you're listening to this before Thursday, the 12th, before noon, go to Kickstarter, and it has some videos, and it lays out a lot of what I've talked about today, and explains where this article is going and what you can do to support it.
Okay. Peter, thank you so much. Peter Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, again, for your work. This is terrific work, and I thank you so much for taking the time to let me interview you today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Bye-bye for now.
Bye.
Another thing that came up during the interview with Peter Byrne that I feel as a woman I should comment on is the issue of how the cancer establishment industry, the cancer industry, which is an enormously rich money-making thing, and obviously there are very disturbing relationships between the cancer registries and money being given to them by Avon and various other kind of cross-fertilization of money and economic interests between these players. So there is this cancer establishment. When a woman receives a breast cancer diagnosis, what happens is that she gets put on a very fast-moving bullet train, and there's not a lot of time. They tell you you don't have any time, and they're pressuring you to start doing treatments right away. The thing is that the treatments that they're recommending never received the kind of clinical trials that, for instance, alternative cancer treatments are getting now. In fact, chemotherapy and radiation have never really received really good peer-reviewed clinical trials to see if they're effective. And the survival rate issue is always based on a five-year survival rate, and it's usually beyond 5 years that a woman will have a reoccurrence of cancer, or a new cancer may start to develop because of the radiation and the chemotherapy. So you have to be very careful about the diagnosis, and remember that there's a manipulation, there's propaganda about women being brave and being congratulated for having survived and being like warriors. And there's all this encouragement. You'll notice you'll look under the covers and you see who's giving the money for these events. Be cynical. Be very cynical. Breast cancer is survivable. It really depends on how a woman changes her lifestyle. It depends on how aggressive the biopsy treatments were, and sometimes just an excision of a lump is enough, and you don't have to do more. It depends. I can't tell you what to do. I can just tell you that it is my opinion that there is more to the kind of push for treatment. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, Your Own Health and Fitness, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, send us an email to admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.